My favorite part about my job.
And so my favorite part of the job.
The best part about my job.
The best part about my job.
Best part of my job.
The best part of my job.
The best part of my job.
Best part of my job.
The best parts about my job.
The best part about my job.
Hey everyone, this is Lars Schmidt, host of the Best Part of My Job podcast. The Best Part of My Job is a weekly exploration of the world of work, where each week we speak with somebody in a new field to learn a little bit more about what that job does, how that career unfolds, and wisdom they may have from their experience to pass along for others that are interested in pursuing a similar career. And I'm very excited for today's guest. Today's guest is actually a former colleague and somebody whose career I've certainly been following and I've learned from. So I'm excited to actually bring his wisdom onto the show, and that is the host of NPR's TED Radio Hour, Guy Raz. Guy, how are you?
Hey, man, how are you? Thank you for that introduction. I'm hoping I will do everything I can to squeeze out any wisdom that I have. Wisdom always makes me nervous because I think of other people having wisdom, like, you know, like a Buddhist monk or, you know, this guy, Brother David Steindl Rast, who I have quotes of his on my, you know, on my computer to remind me to feel gratitude. And so there's some pressure. So I will try. Hopefully I'll dig and find, see if I can find some wisdom in there.
You know, I think that'll be easier than you anticipate.
All right. Okay.
So Guy, for those of you that aren't familiar with Guy's background, Guy has spent his career in journalism, most of that actually at NPR, outside of a two-year stint at CNN. He has had most every role you can imagine at NPR, actually starting as an intern. So there's going to be a lot of different roles and experience for us to dig into over the next half hour. But Guy, the first question I want to ask for you is, what initially drew you to a career in journalism?
Well, I always really loved the idea that you had license to kind of do things that you couldn't ordinarily do. And what I mean by that is that I am not a naturally extroverted person. So if I go to a party, I'm usually like the kind of person who talks to one person the whole night. And like, I'm not really, it's never been my sort of talent or skill set to kind of be the life of the party, which may seem weird, right? Because we have millions of people who listen to the show every week, but it's just not how I'm wired. You know, I tend to be more interested in smaller groups of people, and after a while, I just need to be alone. I just need my space.
Right.
But the thing about journalism, and the thing that I discovered pretty early on, even in high school, I was the high school editor of the newspaper, was I've never felt comfortable just walking up to somebody at a party or even on the street and just striking up a conversation. It's not something I do. But the minute I got a notepad in my hand and then eventually a microphone, it was like being Clark Kent and getting to put a cape on. Hmm. Like all of a sudden, it sort of something clicked in me psychologically that was I was able to kind of transform into this thing, this journalist, this person with a different mission and a higher purpose than just being Guy Raz, you know, asking you questions. It was like, I'm doing this representing this institution, whether it was the high school paper, the college paper, or NPR, it was my job. So it really mitigated things like rejection. You know, I could go up to somebody and if they say, I'm not interested in talking to you, it didn't really make me feel bad because I knew that was my job. But if I did that as just Guy Raz without the notepad or without the mic, it was harder for me to deal with that. And I mean, it seems so weird, right? Because why would there be a difference? But
right.
I remember, I'm jumping ahead, but I remember a few years ago I interviewed for All Things Considered, Neil Diamond, the singer Neil Diamond.
And sure.
I asked him, I said, you know, because he came into the studio with like a baseball cap and like a hoodie, and he looked like, you know, just a schlumpy dude, you know. And this is a guy who plays stadiums of like 50,000 people in glitter jackets. And so I said to him, I said, what's up with the glitter jackets? Can you explain why you wear the glitter, you know, the glitter shirts? And he said, because when I come in here, this is who I am. I'm in my baseball cap. And he said, and when I'm on stage, that's who I am too. But I need to feel like me, but a sort of an exaggerated version of me.
Right.
And putting on that glitter shirt allows me to feel like the performer I need to be. And I thought that was really interesting, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you, so coming out of school, when you, I know obviously you started your career at NPR through the internship program, and I want to talk to you more about that. But what initially drew you to NPR?
I did not grow up in an NPR household. I grew up in a, my parents are immigrants. They didn't speak great English. You know, they, when they came to the U.S. and they didn't really, you know, American culture was something that, that was very new to them. And so I wasn't strapped into a car seat. Actually, there were no car seats when I was a kid. I wasn't put in the back seat listening to NPR. If anything, we listened to talk radio back in the 80s. And there's some really great talk radio. I grew up in Southern California, in L.A. and the suburbs. And we used to listen to Kenneth Bob and Dennis Prager and Bruce Hershenson, conservative radio, a lot of conservative radio at the time. And I got to college, and I just stumbled on the left side of the dial, you know, at some point. I landed on – it was I remember it so distinctly. It was my sophomore year of college, and it was a story about two African-American boys in a Chicago housing project, and it was called Ghetto Life 101. And these boys were narrating their lives, and it was this incredible thing. I had never heard anything like it. It was the most compelling storytelling. I had no idea what it was. Now, it turns out that it was produced by Dave Isay. Dave Isay is the guy behind StoryCorps, one of the most brilliant producers in public radio. And this is one of his earliest pieces back in the early 90s. And so I heard it, and I thought, what is this? What, like, what am I listening to? And that is how I first discovered NPR. In fact, my freshman year of college, I remember Mara Liasson came to speak at my college, and I had no idea what NPR was. Hmm. I didn't even know what it was. You know, I went to go see her speak because she was talking about politics, but it was really only when I stumbled upon it, and that was it. I was hooked. I started to listen to Car Talk. I started to listen to, you know, Weekend Edition with Scott and Weekend All Things Considered with Danny Zwirdling at the time. And I, it, these people became my friends, and I loved it. I loved being around them, you know, in my dorm room, or later on when I moved to an apartment off campus, I wanted to work with them. I wanted to be part of their world because they were so important to me. And that's why I came here. I mean, I had applied for an internship, after my junior year of college. I didn't get it for the first time when I applied. And then I went to my senior year and I did a master's degree in history. And then I reapplied for the internship, and I didn't hear anything initially. And by chance, I got a call one day, and that was it.
Huh. And so you get into NPR, and you know, obviously you came in through the internship program. You had a variety of jobs really kind of all over the newsroom in the U.S. before taking on your first foreign correspondent role in Berlin. And I believe you were 25 at the time, right?
Yeah.
So what was that experience like, kind of starting your career in the newsroom in the States, and then now kind of going overseas and going to places like Berlin to run that bureau and London? How would you compare and contrast kind of the roles you had at HQ compared to the foreign roles now that you were getting outside of the office?
So I should preface all of this, Lars, by saying that what I'm about to do is give you the Facebook version of my life, the highlight reel. And it's actually a really big problem, because when people hear that, they'll hear, oh, you were 25, you became the bureau chief in Berlin. How the hell did that happen? And I, of course, ask myself the same question. What I need to emphasize from the absolute beginning is, in my early 20s, when I started out at NPR, and really into my mid to late 20s, I experienced something that I had never experienced before. And I've had a lot of time to reflect on that over the course of my life, and never really talked about it until recently. I talk about it with friends and with people that I kind of mentor, which is, I had a tremendous amount of anxiety and depression in my early 20s. So when I came to NPR, from the outside, it looked really great. You know, I was an intern, and I was working for Daniel Shore, who was this legendary news guy. And at night, I was writing articles for the Washington City paper. and eventually for other publications, and I was getting more and more of my work published, and I was doing pieces for NPR. At the same time, I was severely depressed, and I had never experienced this. I didn't know what was going on in my brain, because it was totally new to me. And there were periods of time, and because I was a production assistant for my first 2.5 years here, and there were times where I couldn't come to work. Okay, so I would call in sick, or I would, I would basically lie and say I was sick. I can't come in. And I would, there would be 3 or 4 day long stretches where this would happen. And this happened over a period of about 2 years. And sort of on the surface, I'm having all of this success. You know, I'm writing articles, but inside I'm like a mess. And I think part of it was just the fear of a lot of people that age go through, which is all of a sudden you're out of school and there are all these expectations that people have of you, especially if you're like the child of immigrants, or, you know, if you're coming from a circumstance where people just seem to be counting on you, and the safety net's gone. And all of a sudden in your mind, you're like, I've got to achieve. I've got to make people happy. I've got to fulfill those expectations. And you sort of couple that with just the uncertainty of being young and starting out and having people not take you seriously. And, so for me, I had a lot of rejections. You know, I'd write an article that would get rejected. I would pitch a story, get rejected. So for every article that I successfully published, there were 4 or 5, sometimes 10 rejections. And I don't know how I withstood those, to be honest, because I don't think of myself as a particularly perseverant or, you know, gritty person. I can be very fragile, and but somehow I was able to withstand them somehow and just keep moving on, but not without a lot of difficulty. And it was only really around the time I was 25, so shortly before I was picked to be the Berlin correspondent, I had a really, no, I was 24 actually. I went into just a really bad place and really spiraled down. In the meantime, I was reporting for NPR. I was on the air, you know, as a freelancer and a producer. And I grew up in a house where, you know, you didn't seek out treatment for mental health issues. It just wasn't done. And I didn't know what to do, because I thought that I was embarrassed. You know, I couldn't talk to anybody about it. Thankfully, I had a mentor at NPR who to this day is the most important mentor in my life. And she's still at NPR, and she saw it, and she pushed me to go see somebody, and that really changed my life. I mean, I thought I was weak at that time. But now I realize that I actually was very, you know, if anything, I wasn't weak. There was a strength to going to see somebody and to, you know, and to trying to confront this. And it was a really important thing that I did. I went on medication for a few years, and whether that medication was effective or not, I don't know, but it certainly had, you know, at the very least a placebo effect, right? Because it really did help me. It helped me to cope with all those demons that I was kind of struggling with. So, you know, I have very great memories, wonderful memories of being a reporter. Now, when I look back on it, and I'm very fond of those times, but at the time, it was really a struggle, you know, personally and even professionally, because when you're starting out in journalism, nobody takes you seriously. They just don't, you know, and you just kind of have to go through this phase, this period of time where you are struggling. I think about this a lot, like, how do you get around it? And I haven't come up with the answer yet. So by the time I left for Berlin, I was still coping with this and dealing with this, and I was very nervous. I got the Berlin job in a very crazy way, which was, you know, this is NPR in 2000. At that time, if you were of course, a reporter, you really wanted to work for a newspaper, and NPR was a different place in 2000.
Yeah.
And so I was at the right place at the right time. I spoke some German. I had done a fellowship in Germany, and had reported some stories for NPR during that fellowship. And the foreign editor at the time, Lauren Jenkins, he felt obligated to take a chance on a young reporter, because when he was a young reporter, an editor took a chance on him and sent him to Vietnam. Hmm. And so I think he felt like he was duty bound to do that. And he did. He took a chance on me, and it was a huge risk. You know, I was 25. I had very little radio experience. I'd never led a bureau. I was basically a kid. He didn't know I was depressed and on medication, you know, like, I mean, there are all these crazy things. And somehow it worked, you know. I mean, and 90% of that, Lars, was luck. 95% of it was luck. Yeah. People underestimate the power of luck, and luck has plays a huge role in what happens. I mean, you can shape some of your luck for sure, and you can try and work really hard and position yourself, but and that helps. But you know, luck is real.
Yeah. I mean, do you think looking back now that perhaps that change kind of at that stage in your life, going through that physical change? I mean, as a 25-year-old, you're moving to a new country. That's a traumatic experience for anyone. I think in this position you are in, do you think looking back that maybe helped you to have a bit of a fresh start, or was it still kind of part of the healing process?
I think it was a really great fresh start, you know. I mean, and also it basically forced me to focus on work. I was so nervous about going to Germany. You know, I not only was I young, but I looked really young.
Right.
And so, and I got to Berlin, and I was, you know, NPR representative in Germany, and I met the New York Times correspondent. He was in his 60s, and I met the, you know, the Washington Post correspondent. He was in his 50s, and, you know, and the German reporters just, you know, to them, they thought, you know, what's this NPR? Like, they're sending a boy to cover our country, you know? And I remember, you know, doing interviews with Angela Merkel, who was the opposition leader at the time, or Joschka Fischer, who was the foreign minister. And you could just see in their eyes when I would walk into the room, like, who is this interviewing me? What is this NPR thing?
Right.
But it really did focus my mind. And very soon after I got there, you know, my charge was to cover Eastern Europe, was to cover post-communist Eastern Europe and sort of the transition. But I was sort of sucked into the end of the Balkan Wars. So I was sucked into the end of Kosovo and the beginning of the Macedonia War and then the end of that. So that was really became my life sort of from the end of 2000 into 2001, really all the way until August of that year. I mean, there was a peace agreement in August of 2001 between Macedonia and the government and rebels. And it was a big story. It was a huge story. It's crazy to think about now, because after September 11th, everything about what I did overseas changed.
Right.
And I never stepped foot in the Balkans again. So after August of 2011, which up until that point, most of my reporting trips were to Kosovo, Serbia, or Macedonia. After 9/11, it was, you know, we were focused on Central Asia and the Middle East, and it all changed.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that a little bit. You know, after the recent, you know, tragedy in Paris, I've been thinking a lot about just the role of foreign correspondents in particular, but really anybody who covers conflict. And when you're dealing with tragedies like that, and obviously there's a huge you know, human story taking place and massive loss that's taking place, how do you, and this is, you know, I've been wondering about this broadly for journalists, but I want to ask you specifically, because I know you've covered a lot of conflict. How do you deal with that emotionally? How do you kind of immerse yourself in the story to make sure that the world is informed about what's really going on there? But then how do you kind of maybe segment your own personal feelings and emotions and not let those get in the way of the story? And kind of, is there something you take back after you're done covering that to help manage kind of what you've been through?
You know, it's really interesting. I think when I was overseas, I kind of thought I don't even know if I really thought about this, but when I reflect on it now, I think in some ways you operate sort of like a doctor operates, which is, you know, doctors see life and death happen every day. And there are doctors who, you know, go into work and try to save lives, but people die. But then they come back and they do it again. And I think that that's an approach a lot of reporters sort of unconsciously take, which is they are there to bear witness. And so, yes, you do see things that are extremely distressing. And over time, that accumulation of experiences can really be damaging. And I don't know if it's about how you cope with it versus how you're wired.
Right.
So, you know, there were things that would really set me off. Like I spent an extended period of time in Iraq, and I was there most of 2003. I was there for a lot of 2004. I did many trips in 05, 06, 07, 08. But in 04, I was in a military unit for a long time, and they were just, it was just relentless, you know, every day, day in, day out, going out with units, and just, you know, they would engage in firefights. And sometimes they would last like 4 or 5 hours. And it was very stressful because here you are trying to do your job, but you also don't want to be killed. And it's at those moments where you sort of ask yourself, what am I doing? Why is this worth it? And I remember asking myself those questions. You know, why am I here in this place? You know, I can't tell you how many suicide bombings, the aftermaths I've covered, you know, where you see just really just like the sort of the gruesome potential of our species, you know, the things that we can do to each other. And I feel like as a reporter, it wasn't that I was desensitized to it, but I was just so single-mindedly focused on getting the information and transmitting that information that I never stopped to reflect on it. And it really only started to change that perspective once I became a parent. And I can tell you that the story, I mean, I, you know, when I was in Iraq, there was the first bomb attack targeting journalists happened 50 yards from where I was sleeping. And I remember 4 in the morning, a huge explosion, shattering windows in the small hotel that I was staying in. It was at the hotel called the Ike Hotel. It was where NBC was staying at the time. And it was the first time journalists were targeted. It was a very scary moment because we thought we were dead. You know, we thought that we were going to be stormed by, you know, by a bunch of rebels and by a bunch of insurgents. But the story that I remember that. I remember going back to London where I lived at the time, and if I heard a jackhammer, I would jump. You know, I mean, I remember that feeling because when I was embedded at one time, I was with a unit that took 800 mortar rounds in a period of 3 weeks on their forward operating base. And you couldn't sleep, and it was just, it really, you know, messed with your head. And so I would go back to London, and you'd hear jackhammer or construction, I would jump. But the thing that actually really just so profoundly affected me was, happened in December of 2012. I was still hosting All Things Considered, and I used to do a lot of live coverage for NPR. And I get a call from a managing editor at NPR, says there's been a shooting at a school, we think in Connecticut, and that turned out to be Newtown. And I went to be the live host of that from NPR. I never went to Newtown. I never saw the images. I was on the air for 3 hours, and I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I can tell you that story shook me to my core. Like I couldn't keep it together. And there was a moment where I was in the studio with Carrie Johnson, our justice correspondent, and I could barely keep it together because we knew we were not reporting everything we knew yet because we hadn't confirmed it, but we knew a lot.
Right.
And after 3 hours, we passed it off to ATC. And I just broke down. I was like uncontrollably sobbing in the studio. And, you know, she was sitting there. I remember she it's funny because she occasionally we talk about it because it was just us in there. And I mean, that was so crazy to me, you know?
Yeah.
And actually that experience was a real catalyst for me. It is one of the reasons why I really wanted to leave the world of news and to work in a world where we can sort of spread ideas and we can maybe make the world a little bit more of an optimistic place.
Yeah. And I did want to ask you about that. Kind of what was that one of the things that really triggered your interest in the host role at TED Radio Hour when that opened?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I wanted to be part of a world that, you know, here's the thing. I covered conflicts for most of my career. I've covered Israelis and Palestinians. I've covered Pakistanis and Indians, Serbs and Croats, Macedonians and Albanians, you know, I mean, Shiites and Sunnis. Human beings have become, over the course of our evolution, very tribal. And that is a natural, I mean, it's not an unnatural thing. It's just, you know, we tend to gravitate towards people who look like us or speak like us or talk like us or think like us or believe like us. And we talk a lot about identity, and we also talk about the meaning of identity. And I feel like those are really important conversations. But I didn't want to lose sight of what we actually are from 30,000 feet, which is upright, advanced primates, you know, the only hominin species on planet Earth. And we don't talk enough about that. Like, there are a lot of things about humans that are common. So not just our DNA, but the fact that it doesn't matter who you are, where you live, or what culture you come from, we all grieve.
Right.
We're all happy. We're all sad. We all experience jealousy. We all experience, you know, we have the capacity to be violent. We have the capacity to be creative. We love. We hate. These are human experiences. And so I thought, how do we tell those stories about what it means to be human, how we behave in certain ways, how the world around us affects us and changes who we are as a species? So that's really what happened. I mean, obviously I'm a news junkie and I follow the news and I'm interested in it, but like the elections don't affect the TED Radio Hour, you know, or a news event doesn't affect our show because, you know, our show, we can do a show about adaptation, how humans adapted to become who they are. We can do a show about, you know, what it means to be anxious and depressed, which is a show we did recently. They have totally universal impact and appeal. And it's not that we're doing it by not by appealing to the lowest common denominator or being all things to all people. We're just doing it by exploring what it means to be human. And that, to me, is a more profound contribution that I can make as a journalist than a he said, she said story covering a conflict in which it's just not going to get resolved through my reporting. You know, and I just want to be part of a solution. I just want to be part of something bigger. And I feel like what we can do with our show has the potential to just have more impact.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that's why, would you attribute that is one of the reasons why it's one of the fastest growing programs in the history of public radio. It's also one of the top podcasts of all podcasts. Is it that kind of universal nature of humanity that can be explored in the show? Do you think that's the reason why it's so popular?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the main reason, you know. I mean, obviously we really craft a show and we take a lot of care in producing a beautiful radio experience. And we think about the journey through the idea really carefully. But I think the thing about the show is it's like, you know, the old joke about Seinfeld. What is it about? It's a show about nothing. What's our show about? It's a mirror. It's just a show about us. And it doesn't matter whether you live in East Africa or in a high rise in Hong Kong or New York or in London. I think that there is, because we're dealing with human, like a human level problems and issues and questions and behaviors, that everyone listens to it and says, that's me. You know, there's something in that episode where they're like, God, that's me. And we know that because of the people who interact with us. You know, we have listeners all over sub-Saharan Africa, all over the Middle East. It's incredible, you know, all over. I mean, when I was a reporter covering conflict, the only feedback I would get from listeners was, you're biased this way or you're biased that way.
Right.
No one's ever going to say, hey, you know, great work covering, you know, the Sunni-Shia split. No, right. it's people are angry, and I understand that, you know, because especially if you have skin in the game, if you have a stake in that conflict, you don't want your position to be misinterpreted or misrepresented. But with this, it's different. 99% of the people who communicate with us literally tell us we've changed their lives. I mean, I can read you just an email I just got this morning. I'm just gonna find it because it's just another. It's like, here's the email we got. The email we got, it says, "Dear esteemed journalist of National Public Radio, Ted, I've just listened to your episode Quiet, and I could not help but stop and write to thank you for producing and broadcasting the show. In a lifetime of listening to radio, I can honestly say that this is the most beautiful and meaningful piece of journalistic work I have ever encountered anywhere in my life." I mean, That's crazy. We get emails like that every day, and I don't need that to brag or boast. I email that because I'm in awe of it.
Right.
I cannot believe that we get letters from people who say, this show's changed my life. I made a decision to change my life in some way because of something I heard or somebody inspired me to think differently about the world I live in. You know?
Yeah, you know, and I was listening to actually one of your recent episodes earlier today on open source.
Yeah.
And open source being applied to other industries. And it was very profound to me because I actually recently, about a month ago, with a co-founder, launched an open source HR initiative, basically doing exactly what those people in, you know, architecture and democracy were doing in terms of trying to bring something that's traditionally been applied to software and applying it to other industries. So it was actually very the timing was very interesting for me to hear that, because I think that there's hearing their journey and kind of what their experience in is bringing open source to a different industry, I think will really help inform and inspire some of the things that we're working on and doing the same thing in HR.
Yeah. I mean, totally. I mean, that's the thing about that open source show, which is there's so many amazing ideas now. And the one that stuck with me more than any other idea was, if we can solve a problem, like if humans can figure out, if there's a problem and humans can figure out how to solve it, why should we keep solving the same problem
right.
a million times a day around the world?
Yep.
Why wouldn't you just make that available to everybody so then nobody has to solve that problem anymore? And it's just like, it's such a simple idea, but the light bulb clicks at that point. You're like, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I remember that in the show and I heard that and I felt the same way, but I was like, that's exactly it. So Guy, I want to, before we wrap up, I want to spin just to two quick questions that we'll do in a bit of rapid fire. Question one, where do you find your inspiration?
I find my inspiration from my staff. I find it from my kids, and most importantly from my wife, who is the most important figure in my life. I say this, I would say it a million times. If somebody is listening who's maybe younger or not married or is thinking about getting married, it's the most important decision you make in your life is who the partner is. Not married, but who your partner is. Who the person you choose to create a life with. It's such an important decision and more important than any other decision you make. And my, you know, I hit the jackpot. I got so lucky. I mean, my wife is brilliant and kind and just an incredible mom, an incredible thinker and partner. And so she is it. She's it.
And last question for you. What is the best part of your job?
The best part of my job is the way it changes the people who listen to it. I mean, there's nothing better than knowing that you're really having an impact on people, that you are actually changing the way people live their lives or think about their lives, or maybe even something small, like you're just helping somebody have a good day. It's just, you can't quantify that. You can't, like, the value of that is just infinite. And that's what gets me out of bed, you know?
Cool. Well, Guy, I really appreciate you take the time to come on the show and share your story.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Thanks, Lars.
Yeah. What is the, if any listeners want to connect with you on social media or the show, what's the best way for people to do that?
My handle is @GuyRaz, @GuyRaz.
Okay. And TED Radio Hour is @TED Radio Hour, correct?
Exactly. Yes.
Perfect. All right, Guy. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks, Lars.
Take care.
Bye.